been a dedicated student of early recordings for about 20 years. These days, he is focusing mostly on changes in performance style and in the recorded era. He and George Barth are in the process of organizing their second symposium on historic recording at Stanford. In addition to teaching at Stanford, he concertizes regularly across the U.S. and abroad. Ladies and gentlemen, let me first introduce George Barth and then Kumar Arul. Gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's see if we can get the visual up here now.
Details. That one I got. It's that other one.
It's the light gray.
I can start. I will start. Maybe I won't start. Since this is being recorded, I'll give them a moment to work this out.
Got it?
Of course, Jimmy doesn't have a presentation at the very beginning.
No.
This is the just bought it. So it's just cooling off.
It's cooling off?
Because the lights are still on. It's not
the lamp. He's overheating. Promising. Here we go. Okay, well before his first visit to Vienna in 1792, Beethoven was counted among Bonn's foremost keyboard virtuosi. By the late 1790s, he'd conquered Vienna as well. By that time, he was performing on the newest instrument, the forte piano, but that was a relatively new experience for him. The evidence suggests that when Christian Gottlob Neefe, his first really excellent teacher, showed up in Bonn, it was a pretty backward place, and there were no forte pianos at all. It wasn't until about 1793 when he first began to write about it that they apparently appeared there. And Beethoven immediately began composing for the forte piano. 1794, we have his first concerto, which says for harpsichord or forte piano. In his youth, any really aspiring musician would study first the clavichord, which was considered by all the great teachers to be far superior to any other keyboard instrument. Because as Neefe put it, neither the harpsichord nor the forte piano is as capable of cantabile and the various modifications of tone as the clavichord. So it was, this idea of expression was highly prized. That was the most important thing. Modify the tone, be subtle. So in all likelihood, Beethoven started his keyboard training there. His father was in the court orchestra. He was a singer there. By the time Beethoven was 12, he was also working at court, filling in for Nefa when he went away. And at that point, he was also taking over at the harpsichord, leading the orchestra, reading scores at sight. He would play at the Church of the Minorites in Bonn on the organ. So he knew all the keyboard instruments, aside from the forte piano in the early days. And then, at about age 12, he began writing for the forte piano. I mention all this because it has implications. Beethoven's approach to the keyboard is fundamentally different than that for modern pianists, because he began with instruments in which the hands, arms, and fingers alone had to create and sustain the sound. No pedal. As a result, he became part of a tradition. This was something the Germans really prided themselves on. That's why he asks you to play legato melodies in the right hand and staccato left hand, or even legato melodies in the right hand and detached in the right hand, right? They thought this kind of manual dexterity was so important to them that they refused to put pedals on their pianos until about after Beethoven wrote the Moonlight Sonata in 1801, even though the French and the the English had been doing it since the 1780s and 90s. They weren't even interested in volume of sound. The forte pianos didn't even have lid props. They'd just take the lids off if you needed more sound, which sort of dispersed it. They were interested in expression very much. So what this means is that Beethoven was learning to imitate at the keyboard the sounds of group music making, the way some instruments could sustain, others could play staccato, just as in an orchestra, just as in a group of singers and instrumentalists, right? That's what he learned to do. That was the norm. And that's what instruments were designed for, so that you'd have the very silvery top of the forte piano and the very brassy bass and the sort of reedy middle section. Those were as diverse as they could be because they were to sound like different instruments, quite the opposite of the modern instrument. So, once Beethoven found out about pedals, here's his 1805 Erard, 1803. He became fascinated with that sound. Open dampers, you could do it with a stop on the early instruments, you could do it with knee levers, eventually you could do it with pedals. And he began to write in effects in his piano sonatas that are controversial to this day. Some people claim that even on the instruments that he played on, they sound very strange because of the amount of harmonic blending he was willing to have. From the early 1800s, pianos gradually increased in range, from 5 octaves to 6.5. But unfortunately, the only piano that was large enough, now every time the piano increased in range, Beethoven would write for the new note, right? He'd be right there. New piece, new notes, got the piece, right? This was something that interested him a lot. He kept wanting the makers to move on, to create instruments that could do more. But this is the largest instrument he ever experienced, but by this time he was too deaf to hear it. This is the only instrument on which he could perform all of his music. It was loaned to him by Graf, but it was too late. So the very last pronouncement Beethoven makes about the instrument, it is and remains an inadequate instrument. That's in 1826. Okay, that's Beethoven's summary. Right, after the Diabelli variations, Opus 111, all the great works for piano. Okay, this is my summary. Our Steinways are not inadequate. At least they're not inadequate the way Beethoven's pianos were inadequate. So what this means is that for any modern pianist who's playing the music, the first thing you have to understand is that this is an act of transcription. You're dealing with something that's very different than Beethoven was dealing with. He never heard it. He never imagined pianos that could have 70 tons of tension on their frames or whatever. So the question is, what of the subtleties that Beethoven produced, what kinds of subtleties of group music making can still live on a modern Steinway, let's say? Is it possible to do those kinds of effects? How did Beethoven make those kinds of things live? We know from the earliest years that his improvisation could reduce his audiences to loud sobbing, right? The people talked about just being overwhelmed by the feelings that he could call forth in his playing. People like his friend Ferdinand Ries in these, talking about these early years, even here we're talking about the early 1800s and before, they're describing that he could play his pieces very capriciously, zettelalnisch, very moodily. You just never knew what would happen, and they weren't the same way twice. With people like Seyfried, he remembers Beethoven conducting. It must have been something to behold. He would gesticulate in the most incredible ways to try to get across musical ideas. He would shrink down behind the podium when he got soft and almost nothing. And then when in the crescendos, he said he would grow like a giant until he was sort of floating upwards. He would talk individually to members of the orchestra about how to do the rubato, right, in an orchestra. Individual members, you know, this is how you need to take time, this is how you need to take time. So this is what he's doing. Carl Czerny, Beethoven's student, and the one to whom he entrusted the performance of some of the premieres of some of the most important early works, was one who wrote a great deal about how Beethoven expressed himself. And the words that he used are striking. He's talking here about tremendous sensitivity to emotion and character. Entirely new and daring passages, exceptionally characteristic, hitherto unimagined effects, right? Highly spirited, very full of feeling and romantic. This is the classicist Beethoven, right? This is being described by his student. Tone painting of a very high order, conceived of the total effect. The things from the clavichord apparently carried through. Starke remembers the great subtlety, the sort of whispered effects where you could hardly hear it, right? People leaning forward to catch what Beethoven was doing. So in all, we have this sense of tremendous ability to convey character. Czerny was the man who marked the beginning of Beethoven performance studies, in a certain way, the beginning of all modern performance studies. And in his giant pianoforte school, Opus 500, in three large volumes plus a supplement, he spent some of that work talking about how to perform all of Beethoven's works for the piano. It's a section with that title. The proper performance of all Beethoven's works for the piano, he called it. There he delivered some pronouncements that have been quoted very frequently ever since. He's been seen as a kind of pedant, a kind of tyrant, very narrow-minded. Among other things, he said that a metronome mark could fix for all time the intentions of a composer with respect to tempo. A metronome mark. This is actually an outlandish statement, and it's obviously a reaction to a kind of flexibility that was meaningless in his ears, and he wanted to counteract it. Let's turn to a particular example here. Czerny's tempos for the Pathetique. Here's a piece he studied with Beethoven. Four editions. Look at the difference. 46 to 63. This is something he claimed to remember, that Beethoven played it for him, he played it for Beethoven, and yet he couldn't decide, 46 or 63 for the opening grave. Just a huge range of tempos. But it gets more interesting when we look at something else he said. Even if it were possible to reproduce his style of playing exactly, that would be a good idea. Okay. So what's going on here? Are we preserving Beethoven or what? We're not. As a matter of fact, the most important thing, it turns out, is this idea of what Czerny calls the spiritual conception of a piece. It can only be achieved by people who are sensitive, who are mature, who have a tremendously developed sense of taste. They alone will be able to capture the character of a piece, and it will sound different depending on who it is. Here he talks about Hamlet and says, if the great actors play the part of Hamlet, each one will do it in a different way. One person will appear to be mad, another person will appear to be despondent and depressed. Each will bring a different character to it, and they're all correct, right? So the question is, who will step in now to take over this tradition? Well, as a matter of fact, it's the students of Czerny who stepped in. Franz Liszt, Theodor Leszczynski, and Hans von Bülow, coming from that crowd. These were the people from whose studios all the great performers came, as we'll hear in the next section that Kumara speaks with us about. The earliest recordings of Beethoven come from the studios of these three people. And they reveal very clearly an imaginative world with which we are no longer in touch. Kumaran will discuss in some detail two of the characteristics that strike almost every listener. The first of them is that meter in the piano music, in all the music, is understood quantitatively, as if it had something to do with a language in which there were long and short syllables. You'll hear it again and again in performers and conductors. The second thing, and this has, that has a lot to do with the idea that music is like poetry. It comes in syllabic feet. The second thing is that the whole question of the unity of a work with which Beethoven and everyone was so deeply concerned is taken up in a much more complicated way than it is by most modern players. No longer, they simply had thrown out the window the notion that a metronome mark could ever capture the unity of a work, even in a work that appears to be in a single tempo. And that's what we'll be exploring now with these other recordings that we hear.
Good. Well, George is nicely set up where I'm going to take off. He's given us a taste of some of the complexities of interpreting Beethoven's performance style through the sources of the time. Well, in recent years, we're coming to recognize the rich body of recorded sources as well, as another piece in this puzzle. The sonatas of Beethoven provide us with really a wealth of performances on record. However, with the limited time we have today, I'd like to primarily talk about some of the most startling evidence of Beethoven's style that we see in the earliest recordings and rolls, piano rolls. The poorly understood part of our recorded legacy leads to surprising revelations into the nature of performance in 19th century and shows new possibilities for interpreting Beethoven that may have been mostly lost to our day, present day. It may as well provide us with a provocative insight into the way that perhaps Beethoven himself played. The first examples I'll play are all from the first movement variations of the Opus 26 Beethoven Sonata in A flat major number 12. We're going to be focusing here on Frederick Lamond from 1927, and we'll compare him to Arthur Schnabel from 1935 and Daniel Barenboim, in this case, from 1984. Now, Lamond, while not the oldest of artists to have recorded Beethoven, is nonetheless very important because his style is strongly old-fashioned, and he was a revered Beethoven interpreter in the first two decades of the century. He was also the first pianist to record a good number of the Beethoven sonatas, about 8 complete sonatas and the complete Emperor Concerto for HMV in the late 20s and early 30s. This is just before Schnabel recorded his complete set. We'll note that Lamond was respected for his Beethoven playing by Liszt and von Bülow, both of whom he studied with. He also worked with Brahms and was admired by Tchaikovsky, and as with most pianists of his generation, he was an active and accomplished composer. Listen particularly here to Lamond's flexibility of time. It may sound at points disorganized or unsteady, maybe even just strange to our ears, and yet, as I'll shortly elaborate, it defines quite well the primary features of this earliest Beethoven piano performance style on record, a style that's well represented by really a numerous artists on a wide variety of artists, really, and on likely stretches back well into the 19th century. We're going to be looking here at the first edition, actually, of the Opus 26, and we'll begin with Daniel Barenboim's performance from 1984. And now Arthur Schnabel. Is it too loud? Frederick Lamond. And I'd like to look here at bars 18 and 20 in the manner in which Lamond plays a left hand now slightly separated and enunciated against the right hand. And we'll compare that to Daniel Barenboim. Arthur Schnabel. Okay, we'll go ahead to the second variation with Arthur Schnabel. And the same passage with Lamond. And now we'll skip ahead to the fourth variation, and this is Daniel Barenboim in this case. Frederick Lamond, and we'll hear the whole fourth variation with Lamond. So Lamond is quite striking compared with Barenboim and Schnabel's straighter, little more literal rhythms. Hopefully this gives you some idea of what I'm referring to. And I'll have more examples in a moment. This early style that we hear in Le Monde poses quite a challenge to our modern sensibilities, and it may as well yield powerful insights, not least because it's something that we may not have ever imagined without hearing it. As such, it's highly valuable oral, may I say, archaeological evidence. Let me quickly describe what we're hearing a bit more specifically. Robert Phillips' term for this is galumphing. Perhaps somewhat apt, it conjures the sort of image of a quirky eccentric. Others have described it as broken, disjunct, or limping, and even drunken, in effect. But objectively speaking, a bit more objectively speaking, this style is simply created by accenting and emphasizing gestures, in particular small gestures, through both sound and maybe most strikingly through time. This applies to subphrases, appoggiaturas, ornaments, really any localized gesture. And combined with the tendency to lengthen accented notes, leading to irregularly dotted rhythms, a sort of note inégal, to borrow the Baroque term, it feels to us perhaps wobbly in the smallest elements of pulse. And clearly this is the case. However, it's important to note that in most instances, the degree of larger tempo fluctuation is actually relatively small. In other words, the small parts are highly flexible by our modern standards. The transitions in particular, I often think, stand out in this regard. But the larger whole remains, arguably, relatively stable. Another striking feature of the style is the breaking of the hands. One way to explain this is that it derives also from the desire to express localized gestures, but those that come up between the hands. So the left hand may be emphasizing a two-note slur, while the right hand emphasizes a larger phrase over the bar, and thus both hands cannot play their literal rhythms precisely and must diverge for a moment before returning again. Beyond this sort of technical description, the effect we often hear from this approach is complex, perhaps confusing, as I say, but in its own way, very stimulating. There's a sense of tension between the parts, great heterogeny of rhythmic impulse, and a heightened awareness of the details in the music. The intricate shapes within the lines, counterpoint in the texture, subtly weighted harmonic structures, all are brought out. Even in more moderate instances, an attractive lilting rhythm emerges, which seems itself to be a highly desired artistic aspiration for these artists. Now, what I'm describing here has some striking parallels with descriptions of performance practices in the early eras. For example, the separation of the hands we know is strongly associated throughout the 19th century with a particular and most desirable form of tempo rubato, which Richard Hudson, in his notable book on the subject, traces back actually into the 18th century. A notable mention of this by Mozart himself, the separation of the hands, is evidence that this is not a late 19th century romantic creation, as some might think. General tempo flexibility is also consistently mentioned in reference to numerous artists, and perhaps more to the point in this lecture to Beethoven himself, as sources George showed us as well. Well, let's listen to a few more examples. I'll do another comparison with Opus 106 Beethoven Sonata in B-flat major, the number 29, the Hammerklavier. And this is the second F-sharp minor theme from the slow movement. We'll start with Alfred Brendel, and then Wilhelm Kempf, and then Arthur Schnabel. And in this case, Schnabel shows perhaps some of his earlier roots, playing in a decidedly older style. So we'll start here with Alfred Brendel. Wilhelm Kempf. And Arthur Schnabel from 1935. Thank you. Note here Schnabel's use of overdotting, note in Egal, in the right hand eighths, in addition to his general tempo flexibility, a bit of that galumphing. And one final example. This is Felix Weingartner's own arrangement of the complete Hammerklavier Sonata, and from his own recording in 1930 for Columbia. I'd say this takes the idea of reinterpretation a bit further. Another great Beethoven player was Eugen d'Albert. A slightly older compatriot of Le Mans, he was an even more famous protege of Liszt, and also highly respected in his day. I'm just going to play a small excerpt here from his recording of the Beethoven Piano and Violin Sonata, number 5, opus 24, the fourth movement Rondo with Andreas Weisberger. You'll have to forgive here the brief departure from piano sonatas, as we have limited recordings of d'Albert, and this short bit captures his use of this older inflected style. Note here his exaggerated emphases to the first notes of each small slur that Beethoven has marked, creating a mildly dotted rhythm where none is indicated, and the unusual enunciation of the rather simple accompaniment figure in the left hand, even as the violin carries the tune. We're looking here at the manuscript copy in Beethoven's own hand.
First edition.
Oh, this is the first edition. Oh, sorry. Okay.
You have the manuscript?
No. Oh, okay. I'd like to now play one excerpt from a piano roll. Now, piano rolls have been sort of maligned and for many very good reasons, and they certainly have to be approached with great caution. But with care and context, I believe they can yield much useful information, perhaps yet to reveal much useful information. This is Xavier Scharwenka playing the first movement of Opus 90 Sonata on a Welt roll. Note here the pronounced speeding up of the left-hand octaves in the bass, to emphasize this dramatic gesture strongly, but soon thereafter, the completely stable rhythm of the last B minor chords. Also note the dotted rhythm in the right-hand part at the beginning. Interesting to note here that even Scharwenka is connected to Czerny via his teacher, Theodor Kulak. And that means that actually all of our examples of the old style players here are actually just one generation removed from Czerny, the others via Liszt and Leschetizky. It may be apparent to some of you that this type of performance had to emerge from a profoundly different artistic context, a culture of values that sought very different things from performance. And to explore this context a bit, it's useful to consider 19th century attitudes towards style. I use the emphasis on style because, for the most part, they did not see performances of the great masterworks as aiming towards defined aspirations. Musical works were not fixed entities necessarily, but expressive analogs that fostered further creation. These attitudes led to many schools centered on the great musical personalities of the day who forged their own individual styles. In 1846, in his opus 500 pianoforte school that George mentioned, Czerny calls the newest one, represented by Liszt, Chopin, and Thalberg, a mixture of, quote, an improvement on all those that preceded it. Given that one of the schools he identifies is Beethoven's himself, Czerny seems to be almost implying, remarkably enough, that Liszt may be an improvement on Beethoven. Should we say maybe an evolution? It may be apparent by the end of the 19th century, we see that such values as Czerny's are still dominant and diversity of styles are still accepted. However, debates about their relative merits seem to be on the increase, with staunch adherents proclaiming with greater fervor the validity of certain approaches over others. For example, Adolf Christiani writes in 1885, quote, thanks to the many careful and masterly revisions of the classics, notably Bülow's, and to some of the new Chopin editions, the old ad libitum style of interpretation in rhythmic respect, which, note this, only too often resembled the unsteady gait of a drunken man, is giving way to positiveness and precision as far as rhythm is concerned. This is a striking quote, and it seems on the surface to support our notion, my rough hypothesis here, that this old drunken style is pushing back to the early parts of the 19th century, because he refers to it as old in 1885. But he also praises von Bülow for creating greater positiveness and precision as far as rhythm is concerned. And we'll note that von Bülow's edition is full of editorialized additions to Beethoven's texts, including numerous tempo suggestions. And Weingartner, in fact, put Bülow at the first rank of tempo rubato conductors, as he put it. And yet Christiani claims him to be responsible for creating greater precision of rhythm. Could it be that what we're hearing in Le Monde, D'Albert, and others is actually a cleaned up, rhythmically precise evolution of an even older, even more wayward style? Well, clearly musicians of this day were making many fine distinctions with great passion. And without going into a more complete picture, which is sort of beyond the scope of our time today, there can be little doubt that what our late 20th or 21st century tastes may call liberties with rhythm appear to be merely a starting point for artists in the 19th century. We see these debates continue as after the turn of the century as well, but it's clear from writings that this earliest style I'm describing is really on its way out. Numerous artists criticize such techniques and point the way towards a less localized articulative style. The great pianist Joseph Hoffmann, whom we may think of, many of us, as an old style player, actually confirms his place with the next generation, along with pianists like Cortot, Rachmaninoff, and others, by vehemently warning in 1909 that this limping habit, this limping, quote, as he says, is the worst habit you can have in piano playing, unquote. Arthur Rubinstein, as well, criticizes the great Paderewski as the father of a, quote, very poor, affected school of piano playing. There are those who do come to its defense, like T.P. Currier writing in 1900 that Paderewski, quote, has been frowned upon for playing the left hand first in simultaneous chords and in basses accompanying the melody. Yet this form of arpeggiation is indispensable, he says. Many pianists, in their anxiety to avoid its excessive use, carry to equal extreme the square stroke, playing unarpeggiated and exactly together. And then he says, certainly nothing can be more unmusical or tiresome to the ear. We should note that he's defending, for those of us who know Paderewski's recordings, Paderewski for his subtle application of hand separation. Indeed, some of the oldest artists on recordings and rolls actually do show even greater and more consistent separation of the hands than Paderewski does. Well, for my final example, let's hear a bit of this controversial figure, Mr. Paderewski, in the second movement of the Moonlight Sonata, Opus 27, number 2. Thank you. But despite such valiant defenses as couriers for Paderewski, the writing is clearly on the wall for these old-fashioned performers. And while they linger into the later parts of the century, the 20th century, artists like Adelina De Lara, Richard Bulig, Frederick Lamond, and Paderewski even are marginalized in a musical culture that seems to value a new type of virtuosity and brilliance in the rapidly changing world of classical performance. So what are the implications of recognizing and describing this early Beethoven style, if you would, in our recorded legacy? Well, I think it's quite significant, not only to our understanding of Beethoven performance practice from this specific early recorded era, but also towards our conception of the styles present throughout the 19th century. And while this is always a somewhat speculative endeavor, certainly this startling oral evidence may even provide us a glimpse into the styles Beethoven himself may have used. But as well, within the notion of style is contained idea, and these alternative approaches do truly change our understanding of the music and its meanings. It may well be that the lessons we can learn from the 19th century attitudes towards music generally, towards the score and performance, are ultimately more important than any simple claim to authenticity. Thanks.
Hey, does anybody have any questions for the gentleman? We'd like to make it brief.
Yes.
I don't have a question, I have a comment. Segovia, I'm a classical guitarist. Mm-hmm. Segovia's playing is very reminiscent of
yes.
some of these people's playing. And that really illumines a lot of why he may have played that way. This is like a revelation.
Well, in that way, actually, I think guitar practice, you might say, has something in common with the need to break the parts, mm-hmm. in a sense, to make things audible. A little different when we get to string playing, for example. That gets a little more complicated. But I agree completely that Segovia is an example of this sort of early style, although he lingers well, you know, later even.
Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
It's been a pleasure.